Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. Welcome to another episode. I'm glad that you're with me. I'm glad everybody's taking interest in listening in to our podcast and our episodes. Today, this particular episode, my guest contributed to $2 billion growth for clients across 140 industries over 22 years. His own firm has grown 262 times of its original size. But the thing that keeps coming back when his client described working with him is not revenue numbers or framework. It's more of the model that he employs to how these customers work or how these companies work with him and his organization. It's one word, confidence, confidence to grow, and confidence to take calculated risks, confidence to tackle hard things. They would never do it alone, like finance, systems, people, strategy, and scaling. He's also the founder of New Capital Arm that acquires, transforms mid-sized businesses from the inside. Mark Klim, CEO and founder of Magnetic Alliance. Welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat and welcome to the conversation. Nice to have you with me, Mark.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's good to be here and thank you for the kind introduction.
I really appreciate it. You know, Mark joined us, by the way, from Australia. Did I get that right?
Yes.
All right. Because I think on your profile, it says you're from Australia, but sometimes people travel and I don't know where they are nowadays. It's good to have a validation. It's interesting for our global audience, and we do have a global audience from 49 different countries. They listen to this channel and interested in different perspective from different parts of the world. And for this one, Mark, let's get started by this. Do a proper introduction in your own words. The first easy question what we give everybody, Mark, is what is your story? Would you mind telling the audience your story? What got you here?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, going back a long way back, I never really had any experience. I never really had much of resources when I was growing up. I went to university, but I did jobs like mopping, dishwashing, you know, things like that. And, you know, I didn't really have anyone to help or teach me as far as, you know, throughout childhood. And, you know, so I was just a regular guy, regular student, went and got a job. And what ended up happening was I ended up getting a job, working really hard. And within the company, another job opened up. And I applied for that job. And then they forgot they hired me. So they didn't have a computer. They didn't have anything. So someone put me on a desk and there's, you know, at least 100 people on our floor. And everyone was walking past me. And for 2 weeks, everyone kept asking me, are you sure? Are you sure you work here? And I'm like, I think so, you know, but no one's claimed you. No one said you work for them. No one's, you know, you're just sitting here. You have no computer. And I thought it was going to be, you know, I thought maybe I'm in the wrong place. But the big boss walked past and this guy, you know, manages quite a big portfolio, about $3.2 billion in like a portfolio management type of group of businesses, supply chains globally. And he saw me and he said, look, I saw you in an interview and, you know, can I borrow you for 3 weeks? I just need to get some stuff done. So I helped him out. And the 3 week thing that he had me doing, I'd finished it in 2 days. So he said, oh, great. I can get you to do some more things. So he started asking me to do more things and I just did them and did them. And I became kind of like a fixer in the organization of whatever was the problem. So the things became more and more complex and he started sending me to different states, different branches, different businesses, different countries. And essentially I fixed a lot of profit problems in the early days, as well as people and cultural problems that were not working well, system problems, alignment, strategy. So after a couple of years of this pretty hardcore problem solving, I ended up becoming more or less the second in charge of the company initially informally and then become the second in charge formally. So I did that for about 10 years in the corporate world. And then I went and started a business and I didn't really have a product or service. So I thought, well, I don't really know what I'm going to do, but I just want to grow and maybe I can just help businesses grow with my experience. So I started advising businesses and helping them sort problems. And over time that grew to about 85 services because there are a lot of things that they just go, look, I know what you want me to do, but I can't do it. So can you do it for me? or can you do it with me? So I created services and helped them implement, because there are a lot of people out there giving advice, but not many people involved in the implementation. I had to find, as a new business, where I could add value, where the gaps were. So I thought, okay, well, I can help in implementation, and I can do things that they can't do. So they do what they're good at, I do what I'm good at, and we make it work. So in that time frame, we helped a lot of clients, and the revenues that they reported to us was over 2 billion. When we stopped counting, it was like 2.1. If it's in Australia, if it's overseas, it's probably more like double that. But after a while, we thought, we're doing a lot of good work, and our clients really love it, and we've grown their businesses. We should grow our own. So we decided, well, why don't we grow our own businesses? And so we took investments and shares in various companies, and we grew those too. And that's where our own growth comes from. And so we did that for a number of years, and we grew pretty much all the businesses that we were involved with, or shares owned equity or partnered with. And now we thought, well, you know, we're doing a lot of work to take a small business to get to medium. So it's the same work for us to go from small to medium, then a medium to a large. So, you know, we'd like to acquire or access larger businesses, but you need more resources, more capital to do that. So to get to the size that we want to acquire. So we then started a investment fund, and now we have an investment fund. So it's kind of just bounced from one thing to another, but it's not doing different things. A lot of business owners think, I've got to start multiple businesses. It's not that we wanted to start multiple businesses. It's just that it led to the next stage. And so we're not doing different things. We're doing the same things. We're just going deeper and deeper into it. So we do have a collection of businesses, but really it's just one business, and it's just gone deeper and deeper into further stages of growth. So now we're raising capital, and we're looking to acquire businesses that are, you know, considered boring, you know, things that are not like really new, not tech, not like any inventions. We're just taking boring businesses and we're making them great again with, you know, bringing profitability back, you know, bringing more sales in, better systems, better structures, better strategies and processes. So, and a lot of housekeeping and tidying up. So for us, we tend to do the simple things and do them well. And that's our focus. So hopefully that gives you a bit of a background on what we do.
Of course. Of course. Thanks for that. I really appreciate it. And for the audience, just so you know, before Magnetic Alliance, Mark was the number one CPA in Australia. You won an American Express Award for Business Strategy. Congratulations. And you spent years inside Elders running a large commercial portfolio. So, you know, you came from the finance background. It's very interesting. And it gives you that finance lens on how you look at businesses. I've got two questions for you on that one. When you select these businesses, is there a specific industry you select or you try to be inside of or interested in? And the second thing, does the financial lens that you carry, I'm sure a great help in looking at the financial statements and where profitability is and the blind spot on profitability, margins, etc. Is there any other blind spots that perhaps you, and I'm thinking here on a go-to-market, revenue generation, that kind of thing, that, or you seek help from somebody else out there? Sorry, I bundled a bunch of things in one question.
No, that's okay. So yeah, look, I did have a finance background, and I was involved in quite complicated finance across, you know, we had multiple entities. We had something like 200 entities. When I was working in the corporate, we had all sorts of mergers, acquisitions. We had international operations. We had transfer pricing, foreign exchange. We had all the complicated different financial requirements across different industries and different countries. But the more complex it gets, the more I like to simplify it. Right now, we're just saying, let's just double profit. Whatever we touch, let's just double profit. And, you know, the blind spot in finance, and when it comes to profit, the blind spots we see depends where it is. If it's in the big business world, it's the complexity. Everything is so complex. Everyone speaks in jargon. And they focus on all these metrics that are very fancy, but really, I just look at the simple stuff. are you making profit? And is the profit real? Is it engineered or is it actually a profit that has been delivered from real tangible value creation, not financial engineering? But in the small business world, it's actually quite scary because a lot of business owners, I would say, you know, a good 90% of business owners that I come across, number one, do not even have financials that they understand. That firstly, they don't have the visibility. And secondly, they don't understand it when they do have it. Really, it's like a pilot who's managing the cockpit of the plane, and they've got all these instruments there, levers, buttons, and everything, and they don't really know what those things mean. So it's pretty scary because they're the ones flying the plane, and that's why there's such a huge amount of insolvencies. The stats are pretty scary. Something like 96 to 99% of businesses fail within its first 10 years. And 30% of the failure is due to poor financial controls. So they just didn't get the finance. They don't know, even when they make a profit and they have to pay tax, they don't plan for it. And then it hits them and all of a sudden their cash flow's gone and they can't make payments. And all of a sudden they're in liquidation. And they think, how did this happen? I did well. I made profits, right? But you know, it's, so that's the thing. And the second thing that I find, and this is across the board, across all businesses, is that the business is not designed for profit. Like they don't design profit in. They hope that profit will eventually come from whatever activities they do, but they don't design the business to be profitable. So they don't design it in. It's kind of like, hey, I'm building a home and I'm putting bricks in and I'm making rooms and I'm doing, but you didn't design it. So in the end, you go, did we do the right thing? Did we get the right result? And a lot of times, you know, you've seen companies go down who don't have a profitable design, right? They just raise capital, grow, raise more capital. And then eventually they figure out, I'm kind of out, you know, that's it. So that's the second thing. They don't design the business for profit. And then thirdly, the third thing is, do they actually have the right strategies to be profitable? It's like you design the profit in the structure of your, you know, how the business runs, but then you need the design to put those profits in. And that can be multiple things that you create to make the business profitable. So you got to allow the model to be profitable, but then you've got to actually put the profitability in through the strategic initiatives that you put in to grow that business's profit. So those are the three key things that really 99% of business owners I talk to, they just don't have it. And that's why only 1% gets to the mid-size.
And from what I'm hearing from you is profitability by design. Mm-hmm. And designing these elements is very, very important, especially at the stage when you're starting a company. And what tend to happen in a startup company, like everybody knows, we're focusing on the first customer, we're focusing on a little bit of revenue that probably going to be generated. And this is where things get a little tricky because every company gets started and you're right, there's a high degree of failure at the beginning. Yeah, I agree with you, finance is a big deal. Leak profitability, you did not really account for where the money is going. Cash flow, normally that's where companies fall apart is on cash flow. They don't have enough money in the bank and they start selling. Mm-hmm. But the biggest problem I feel, and I've seen this, that, you know, after 40 years in business, is product market mismatch. Somebody dreamt a product somewhere or a service somewhere that thought there must be a buyer for this. And I've seen this over and over again. You can correct me if I'm wrong. You're more expert than I am at this because you do this for a living. I only been involved in it in several companies that I've been involved in. You have a much more statistical evidence for this one. Somebody created something in the lab and they thought, oh, it's a great idea. I mean, let's put it together. Somebody must buy this. And then we find out later that only one or two customer buys it and there's no market for it. But we've built a huge expectations. We went out, got funding, put some stakeholders in place, but this didn't really materialize. And I'm talking about the ones that fail, but obviously there are many of them out there that they're successful and they do very well. Do you find in your journey so far that some of those cases, before we get to, you know, you've got your house financial, the finance house in order, before we get to that stage, there's an idea issue here?
Yeah, you're right. Because, you know, like I said, 30% fail because of poor financial control. But the actual biggest failure is the 40 to 45%, depending on the year and the country and all that. But, you know, across over time, it's about 40 to 45% failure is due to poor strategy. And part of the strategy is, do you have the right product? Do you have the right market? Do you have the ability to sell your products into the market and be able to win? So yeah, 100%. I see that all the time. People have an idea and they think, wow, I'm going to sell this thing. I have this new idea. And it's nice, but most of those ideas never get off the ground because you have to commercialize it, right? People want to create something, invent something, put in a new model. You have to figure out whether people want it or not, or people need it or not. And some people don't realize that they have maybe it is required in the market, but there's an education process because if you are creating something new, people don't know about it. So they don't know what to do with it. They'll try and put it in a box. And if they're not clear, they're not going to buy. And then you don't have a market that you can service. So yeah, it happens all the time and people make that mistake. So what we do to counter that, because we've made 85 products and services, not all of them are, you know, like taking off as far as sales, because that's why we have so many services, because we're constantly market testing. We're our process is we sell it first, then we create it. If we get enough demand, then we build the product. It takes a very, very special person like a Steve Jobs to know what the customer wants before the customer knows what they want. So you have to be a Henry Ford. You have to be a Steve Jobs. That's one in 800,000, you know? Yeah, maybe one of those will take off, but the majority of people will not make it. You know, they're visionaries, and that's extremely rare, you know, and they're right, because in what they do, like Henry Ford says, if you ask the customers what they wanted, they'd say faster horses, right? But he had the vision to create vehicles, and Steve Jobs created, you know, a computer in your pocket. So they have that vision. Not many people are of that kind of mind. So for the majority of us, we need to ask the customer, what do they want, or what do they need, or what problem they're having? If the bigger the problem they have, the more chance you have of selling that product. If it's not a big problem, if it's not a problem they're going to pull their wallet out and start paying for, then you have to rethink the product. So actually, in my first kind of early first year, I drew stuff up on the whiteboard and I talked to people. I asked them what their problems were and I drew up on the whiteboard. I said, if I did this and this and this, would that solve your problem? And they said, yeah, that would. I said, okay, well, what are you willing to purchase if I were able to do this? And they said, okay, well, I'll pay that for that. You know, I'll pay this. And actually, my very first one that I did, I drew three boxes and I said, I can do one, two, three, and I'll do it for 10,000, 10,000, 10,000. Which one do you want? And he said, how much for all three? I said, okay, well, I'll give you a $5,000 discount, 25,000. I'll do all these three things. And that was my sale. And then I built the product because I already knew I had a buyer. Whereas a lot of people build the product and they go, now what?
Like, now what?
Now what do I do with this? You know? So that's a very big mistake in terms of your marketing product development.
Totally. And, yeah. You know, you reminded me back in the days, and again, this is a conversation, that's not an interview. So one of the anecdotes I always share is, well, I've shared it once, maybe this is the second time. I was selling fiber optic testers for a company that's based not in Canada. I won't name any names. And the customer who bought the test bed from me, I was quite surprised. It was a very large test bed at the time. And the cost was over $3 million for one transaction, US dollars. And then when I was asking a little bit more, trying to find out what product are they building, they were building this particular product, which is a card, an electronic card that goes into a passport switch. That's the telephone switch that facilitate communication, internet, telephone, et cetera, various types of communications. And the card was so massive, so big from a capacity perspective, that when they tried to sell it the first time, the first customer, which is the largest telephone carrier in the country, the question from the customer was, so you mean I'll take one of those cards, I'll put it in the center of the country, and one third of its capacity, it will be equal to the entire communication traffic for the country. So how many of those cards are you going to sell? So the question is developing a product, that's fine. Doing research, like everything nowadays cannot be on a hunch. I mean, you drive a very valid point. It has to be on a research. I do work back in the days, I used to work with a lot of market research companies. You do need to do your research upfront. You do need to understand what problem are you trying to solve, not try to find a problem to a solution that you built. Well, we don't know if it's a solution, right? So it's, I love your approach. You know, what is the problem? Let me go build a solution for you. Versus a lot of people imagine that there is a problem and this could be a solution. Could be is not a for sure thing.
Yeah, definitely. Like the market research firms are okay. Those market groups and forums and stuff. I kind of cut through all that because
just go straight to the customer.
You just go straight to the customer and say, how much are you willing to pay for this? And if they don't pull money out of their pocket, the research don't matter, because those research groups will they could say, yes, there's a demand for this. We ask them, but when it comes time to pull the money out, it's a different story.
100%.
So I like to go straight to the source where they're going, all right, here's what it's worth to me. Bang.
That's right. Now, you have a very unique model, though. I mean, you operate as a co-CEO inside of a client businesses. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? What does that model look like? And do you exit at some point, or you did your job and you walk away? You're not just an outside advisor. You're inside the business. How does that work, Mark?
That's kind of like what we did when we started. So a lot of business owners were experts at their trade, their craft, their profession. And, you know, let's just say they're an electrician, they're a mechanic, they're a plumber, they're a radiologist, they're an architect, an accountant. They're good at that thing, but are they a good CEO? Right. So in doing what they do, they're essentially the operator. You got sales, you sell the product, you got operations, you deliver the product that you sold, then you've got the back end. So essentially, when they're an expert at what they do, they're the operator. Right? And if they're really good at their operation, they will sell because people will like the quality, they'll get referrals, etc. But what they're really good at is being an operator, and that's a job inside the business. So they're in the business. And so what I help them with is get them to think outside of that and think, how would a CEO think? What would matter to a CEO? What decisions would they make? How would they structure the business? Are you going to remain an operator? How long for? How are you going to get out of it? You know, how are you going to expand? How are you going to fund it? How are you going to think about other things beyond your current size? So I did that for a long time. And now I do so more in a group setting where I mentor people. They come to our boot camps. We have a mentorship group. But yeah, it's a co-CEO because they don't know how to be a CEO. They're operating predominantly either in sales and someone does the job, or someone else does the sales and they do the job. They're in the business. They're not, the CEO is on top of the business. They're not doing the work. The CEOs are not the ones delivering the product or delivering the service. So that's how we work, is get working with the owner and turn them from an operator to a CEO.
Now, you know, one of the, and I totally agree with you. I mean, you look what's going on. Bill Gates no longer, I mean, he's the idea behind Microsoft, but he's not managing Microsoft. And many examples out there where you have an idea person that created something good, it worked. You've done the job, you've saw a need, you created a solution. Great job. Are you the right person to continue managing that company forward? And many entrepreneurs struggle with that. I work in the language industry. There are 19,000 companies in our industry or thereabout. The majority of them, 80% of them were started by translators who went to university, studied linguistic degrees, and they came in and they said, oh, you know what? I can put together a company and I can provide translation services. Now, scaling that company, take it to the next level, modernizing, keeping up with the technology, I don't think it's the founder's forte to take it to that next level. And this is where they need to move on. I mean, step aside a little bit, let somebody else run it, take it to the next level on a business side. And perhaps the expertise for that individual resides in other things that they can do in the organization, which always be the case. But I get your message, and the audience, probably they're understanding this as we speak here. Know what skills you provide or you bring to the table and enhance these skills, work within those skills. And if you notice, don't be shy. If you notice that you can't manage something, just step aside and get somebody else, some experts, to help you in manage the next level.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that... Go ahead.
Well, there's a study with McKinsey that says 85% of founders cannot get past the ceiling of a mid-sized business. Once they reach somewhere between 30 to 50 million, they're no longer able to scale because they reach their ceiling. Like, so for example, if you're a plumber, right, or you're an electrician, whatever it is that you're a dentist, you're good at drilling holes in people's teeth. You're good at fixing pipes, right? That's what you did for a long time. And then you hire someone else because you're not going to keep doing that. Someone else is the plumber and you're training them. You're showing them how to do that. At some point, you can succeed to a certain extent. But then the problem with the mid-sized business in that 30 to 50 million range is they start needing to create a head office. They start needing a finance team, a CFO. They don't know how to like a plumber doesn't know how to manage a CFO. How do you know if they're even good? How can you tell the quality? How can you tell if your marketing team is any good? How can you tell if your IT team knows what they're doing, right? So that's why a lot of these businesses, they stop at that 30 to 50 million. They really, really struggle because the founder has reached their ceiling. They're no longer the person that is able to grow that business. And so that's why at that stage, usually profits decline. And there's a Harvard Business Review study showing that a lot of these mid-sized companies that were profitable on the way to that mid-size, the profits decline because you start having to build these teams and you're spending money and you're wasting it. You're going to have to replace that person and replace that team and you're just burning until, you know, you professionalize, then that's when they start making profit and growing again. And usually that takes a different set of people to take that business to the next level. And that's essentially what we are. You know, we've taken businesses from zero all the way up to hundreds of millions of dollars alongside our clients. And we know how to set those things up because we come from a head office. We come from an environment where we enhance those things and structure those and restructure and refine it and strategize how to do it the best. That's, you know, 10 years, decade of my experiences in doing that and making models that work better and that can help scale better. And so, you know, it's really hard and it's not the fault of the operator or the owner. They just didn't have that background. Just like I can't fix pipes and I can't, you know, pull out teeth, you know, it's a different skill set. So I think you're right. People have to just recognize that, hey, look, I'm going to hand this over and take a kind of like an expert role, but, you know, let someone else run the business who knows how to do it.
No, I do work beside podcasting and recording excellent conversation with my guests. I am actually a CRO by a fractional CRO. So I provide CRO services and advisory to many companies in the small to medium size. And I selected small to medium size because I see an opportunity there, big opportunity. And normally what tend to happen in my domain, and I'm reflecting on what you're saying, Mark, as well, is small founders or small company founders or SMBs. And I don't know, maybe what is the qualification for an SMB in Australia? Like
in
what
Australia,
size?
It's 0 to 10 million is considered small. From 10 million to 200 million is a medium, and 200 million and above is large if you're looking at a taxation point of view.
But from a taxation point.
Yeah, that's how the tax office defines the size.
In Canada, if you are below 200 employees, you're considered a small to medium in that category. So most of them, though, in the small to medium, they have no idea how to build like a sales structure, for instance. That's the go-to-market stuff. They still rely on, you know, word of mouth in a lot of cases. I've heard a lot of people, they tell me like their customer service, the people who are receiving the orders are in charge of selling. Mm-hmm. And just some stuff there, it doesn't make any sense. And so in all of this, and I'm just reminded here that, you know, when somebody is listening to our conversation right now, Mark, they're probably wondering like what business model do you utilize with your customers in a way for you to make money? So how does your company make money? Is it a fee for service? Is it a share in the company? Or is it some other mechanism that you utilize? What's in it for you, basically?
Oh, we're all of the above. It depends on what the business needs. So if they need a project, we charge a project fee. If they need personnel, we charge a personnel fee. A membership, we charge a membership fee. If it's something that is a partnership, then we have equity involved. We have 85 odd different services, and we have about a dozen different models of how we charge fees, performance incentives, and whatever we get paid. So it's whatever suits the type of service that is being provided.
No, just want to move to some of your customers' feedback and the consistent feedback that you've heard. You probably can validate that. Tell me if I'm wrong. From your customers, is you give them confidence.
Yeah.
Not a revenue projection or framework, confidence. Now, when did you realize that this is actually core to what you're delivering?
That's actually a really fine point that you picked up on, because that is something that we realized when we interviewed a lot of our clients. Like, what do you really get from us? They go, oh, we get strategies. Like, okay, but yes, but what do you really get from us? They go, well, we get support, and we get to take risks, and in the end, it always comes back to one thing. And you're right. And that's something that we, around about 2015 was when we realized that if you take all those things that they get from various things, it always comes down to, I have the confidence to take a leap because I know you're with me. And if I fall, you're the net, because they don't know what to do. And so they don't pull the trigger, they don't jump. But if we're there, they go, yeah, we'll do it. It's like, I don't know how to build a sales team. I don't know how to build a CRM. I don't know how to build the structure. And if you're going to help me do it, okay, let's go. So that's what they really get. And we've quizzed a whole bunch of our clients, and that's what it comes down to. So you picked up on something that's really nuanced, and it's not obvious to the common eye. So yeah.
No, I really appreciate that.
You have a good insight there.
No, I did a little bit of research on yourself, Mark, and the company, and I do this for all of our guests. I hate to walk into a conversation not knowing about what I'm going to be talking about or what subjects I'm going to dig deeper into it. And it's part of why this channel continued to be successful, is that type of conversation that takes a little bit of a depth, and nothing is superficial in our conversation here on this channel. So I really like to dig into what the topics that I'm going to be discussing. Plus the various conversation that we've had over the year and a half, 2 years now on this channel, gives me that broad perspective on the type of education that I've gained over all along the way here as a host from the various guests that shared their experiences with me. Now, when it comes to confidence, though, specifically on the topic of confidence for some of your customers, correct me if I'm wrong, but there must be some friction between, or tension between, what I call confidence for some people, lack or lack of, or some confidence too much sometimes becomes delusional. And so how do you pull back and push? Where do you know where to apply or pressure to push out to gain more confidence? And some of these people that they probably need to be pulled back a little bit to a more realistic way.
Yeah, it depends on the delusion meter, right? If it's really obvious, we just don't touch it. Because you know that you're so far out. Like we had someone once, and they were at 2 million, 2.4. And we always do surveys, and we said, okay, how long did it take? How many years have you been in business? They said 36 years. And what's your goal for next year? I said, when are we going to get to 5 billion? I said, did you mean 5 million? Like 2.4 million to 5 million? They said, no, 5 billion. And I said, so hang on. It took you 36 years to get to 2.4 million. And in 12 months, you want to get to 5 billion. Do you know the difference in how many zeros are there between where you are and where you want to go? And I said, yeah, we've got the best product. I said, look, I am afraid with this kind of mindset, you will go broke. And there's something there because they feel like they're running out of time or something, right? So they have to have these massive leaps. So anyway, I declined that kind of stuff. And within about 12 to 18 months, they were broke. And everyone I've called out that they're going to go broke has gone broke. And I look at that delusion meter, and if it's extremely high,
I love that delusion meter. I'm going to coin that delusion meter.
The delusion meter is over the top, like, you know.
That's right.
If it's just a little bit, sometimes I let it kind of go, because sometimes you don't know. Like, you don't know where they could reach beyond where they think or what I think. So if it's, if I think it's slightly crazy, doable, unachievable, I kind of go, well, let's see. Let's see. But if I, the point where I kind of push back is where I know it's going to hurt the business, where I know they're going to go all in and put all the chips in and then risk everything and then lose it. So,
you know, yeah, even like for me, even like for me, like on a CRO, I've seen a lot of CRO function that I do. I've seen a lot of incidents where, or a lot of cases where you've got the owner of the company wants to grow, but nobody in the other, in the organization. And that's a small organization, maybe 50 employees, whatever. Not many people other than him who shares that same opinion of growth. And then you've got an entire team behind you, you know, naysayers, I would call it. Meanwhile, the CEO wants to grow. And then you go back to your original example of billion, how many zeros this individual wants to grow their organization. I mean, there's no math to support even the delivery organization. Like, how do you go from small to large to that many zeros in your revenue projection? And you don't have the right delivery structure. Like, do you have enough people to produce what you're going to be selling for that much? I mean, there's no realistic way of figuring this out in their mind.
Yeah, and it's not that it's impossible, because other people have reached 5 billion before. But the big key here is the time.
The time factor.
Right?
Yeah.
If you said, I give myself, you know, 20 years to do it, well, you never know.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Like a few years ago, I got on a plane. From Washington. There was somebody sitting beside me. He says, Robin, I want you to come and help me with my team. I said, okay. And I, when I joined the company, there were like $800,000. And I said, okay, well, what's your plan? What's your five-year business plan? Not 2 months, five-year business plan. And he said, what do I want to get to 20 million? So we ended up getting to 29 million in 5 years, which is good. But there is a business plan. There's no overnight, you know, flip the switch and all of a sudden, even people who are selling in the pharmaceutical world who are selling insulin, they're not growing that much, because there's people other than, you know, selling that market. I mean, you got to displace your competitors.
Yeah, absolutely. Having grown businesses from even just like a few staff to like 30 or 40 staff in a very short period to take a $20 or $30 million contract, we know what it takes. We know what kind of crazy speed, like, you have to get to do that. And it's possible, for it depends on your capability. If you had prior experience in an organization at that level, then I would be like, okay, no problem. Like, we have had a client grow 35 million first year, 90 million second year, 130 million next year. And by year five or six, they're at 250 million. No problem, because they have that background. But when you take someone who's taken 36 years to get to two, and then in 12 months want to get to five, the delusion meter is off the chart.
The delusion meter.
And so, you know, I just have to kind of really, and it's actually quite common. I would say, because people apply to work with us, and in the application process, we ask a series of questions, and we ask, you know, these goals and targets, and there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them. And they're not all after that 5 billion, but they might say, okay, I'm on $30,000 a year. Okay, what's your goal next year? I want to go to 30 million. It's like, well, okay, so you've been in business for 3-4 years, you've just made 30,000, and now you want 30 million. And they don't even have any concept of profit. 20 million of that they want in profit. So show me a business with 60 or 70% net profit margin. You know, it's crazy. You know, I just avoid those people. But if it's kind of near realistic, I just let them go, see what you can do. But
yeah,
if it's at a point where they're going to hurt the business, that's when I push back. That's the main thing.
Now, Magnetic Alliance is a relatively young company. You know, you've started it in 2025, if I got the research correctly here.
Actually, the fund is 2025. However, the Magnetic Alliance started in 2000, and we're about
15 years old. So what's the difference, if you don't mind, just for the audience?
So Magnetic Alliance is a growth services business, whereas Magnetic Alliance Capital is a brand new fund.
And okay.
The fund is an investment vehicle, whereas the growth services helps business owners, create strategies and implement growth.
So the fund part, is it like a private equity or is it how does it?
Private equity. Essentially private equity.
And this is where you go buy companies, grow them, either keep them or sell them and create value and not increase. Typical PE firm, yeah. I'm assuming, yeah?
It's typical PE firm with a bit of a twist. And the twist is a typical PE firm. Let's say if you have a PE startup, for example, you might have a couple of guys who are ex-investment banker, fund manager, and they will raise a bunch of money and they'll buy businesses. And then they'll have to find someone to run it. They'll have to find someone to consult in. And they take a very, very high up view, the 30,000 foot view, because we're coming at it from a... we have the guy with the fund's background who's run big funds before, investment bank, but we also have the portfolio management expertise. So rather than hiring someone,
to use your own services.
We have our people who can do that. And then instead of hiring another firm to come and advise, we have that too. So we have like a trifecta of what you need to be able to do but really, like, you know, if you buy a business and you don't have much control, you don't have much influence over the operations, you're kind of hoping that your investment will do well. Whereas we have a lot of control over our investments. We can make it do well. We don't have to wait to find the right people and hopefully their strategies work. We have our own strategies. We have our own team. We are able to implement. We're able to effect change very quickly.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the actual structure of the various companies, including the capital arm of the company, the Magnetic Alliance Capital and the Magnetic Alliance, the advisory and the services side. How big is it? Where is it located? What countries you operate in? What is a good investment or a good customer or whatever you want to define them at that you would like to be involved in?
Yeah, so as far as the advisory and implement growth services, our target market there is, we've had up to $10 billion clients revenue and we've had startups, but our sweet spot is in that $1 to $5 million range because we can do so much for those people. We can deliver what we deliver in a very economical way. A lot of people are saying we're half what anyone else cost and we provide double or triple whatever they provide. So we're not really cheap, but we are high value for money. So, and we can create a huge benefit for those guys because that's really the painful point where they're really struggling and we help them get from that struggle to that eight-figure mark. And at the eight-figure mark, they usually have a seven-figure profit. And so it's really a life-changing thing. You go from struggle and having a wage to now I'm cruising and I have like I win the lottery every year essentially. So, you know, we can make a lot of impact when it gets, you know, larger in the fund side of things. Mm-hmm. Our target market is different. Like the businesses that we are looking to acquire ideally would be in the 30 to 50 million revenue range with a 2 to 5% profit margin. And we want to take that 2 to 5% and make it 10%. So we either double it or we up to 5x it. And if we are able to 5x that profit, then we've 5x the value of the business.
And so, and the area you operate in geographically?
We're in Australia. So currently our scope with where we're buying businesses is in Australia, but it doesn't mean it can't trade. We have a opportunity right now to distribute to Asia. So we're looking to buy Australian businesses, but we can export overseas. And we are also having overseas investor interest. So we're able to take investors from overseas, we're able to export overseas, but the actual country that we're buying businesses in is in Australia, just to keep it simple to start with.
Now, if, you know, just as we continue our conversation, we're coming to an end here as we wrap up our conversation. If a business owner right now, Mark, is listening to our conversation and, you know, trying to figure out what to do next or unsure what to do next, what do you like them to take away from this conversation?
Yeah, look, there's no one answer because every person is at a different point in their business, in their life, what is important to them, what is a priority. Someone who's a baby boomer might want to exit, right? Or another one might want to pass on their wealth to their children and have their children run the business. Just that alone is two different, you know, an exit versus a succession plan is very different. And if they're in the younger, earlier stages, it's also different. So the biggest thing that I could say that the best thing for them to do is one thing they'll never lose money on is investing in their own self. They invest in their own knowledge, their experience, their own skills and capabilities. Even if you lose it all, you can bring that to the next business or a next job or whatever it is. You take it with you for life. So every dollar you invest in yourself, you always keep, no matter what happens.
Correct.
So if I were to put it into one thing for them to take away, it's don't be afraid to spend money in investing in yourself, right? And a lot of people are afraid to do that. They're thinking, well, if I use that money, it's gone. It's not gone. If you don't believe in yourself, then you're not going to invest in yourself. But that is the biggest ROI you can get, is the investment in yourself.
Absolutely. And my last question, after 22 years for you and 2.1 billion in client growth, what do you know now that you wish somebody have told you from the beginning?
I think what I know now is that there's not much difference between growing a big business or a small business for what I do, right? And I probably would have started with larger businesses if I were to do it again, because it's the same amount of work. There's just more zeros. Like if you were buying a stock in the stock market, whether it's $20 or $200, you do the same amount of work. You have to research the company. You have to do all the same things to compare. You know, so that's probably one takeaway for me at this stage of where I'm at. If I were me now and I were to meet me when I started, I would say, hey, look, just start off at the mid-size because it's going to be the same amount of work as a small business. And that's what I would tell myself.
You know what? I really enjoyed this conversation, Mark. Any last comments for our audience?
Look, I really love these conversations and I just love businesses. And for me, I know I'm in the field where I'm talking about profit, revenue, and it's all money related. And, you know, it's something that is part of the job. But for me, like you said at the beginning, what I really love is the person you need to be able to grow, because you need to be a big vessel to be able to receive, right? It's like if you have a small cup, you can only carry so much liquid in it. You have to create a big vessel to carry more. And that's why, you know, self-development is such a big thing, because if you create a big version of yourself, you can do more. And for me, it's really about reaching potential, right? Whatever potential people have, if it's 100,000 is their maximum potential, then just reach that. If it's 1 million, reach that. If it's more, then reach that. I just think that we're blessed to be where we are, to have the ability to start a business, the ability to give things a shot. I need to do my best and I need to be able to realize my potential. Otherwise, why did I get what I've got? Right? Might as well give it to someone else. If I have been given a brain and arms and hands to do things, I might as well use them. Otherwise, someone else would benefit better from them. So it's like an investor, right? If they're going to put money with me and I don't use their money, why should they put their money with me? They might as well put it somewhere else where it will be put to use. So that's a big thing for me is, you know, people say, oh, why do you keep on working? Why do you work hard? Why do you keep starting stuff? Why do you like, it, when's enough? You know, it's like, well, it's not about enough. It's not about, you know, any of those things. It's I need to reach my potential. Like, why does Elon Musk keep working? You know, he's already almost a trillionaire. It's not really the money. It's not really the achievements. It's not the awards. It's not the accolades. It's just you have this potential. Who knows what you could do? And, you know, we've been able to help many people change their lives, and that has a ripple effect. So, you know, I think whoever you are, whatever you're doing, do your absolute. We have a saying in our culture. It's written on our wall. We practice it. We practice what we preach. I always say, be your best and then be better, because your best is no longer enough. Right. So be your best, then be better.
And then do better.
You're surprised, because you go, this was my best, but then I was able to achieve this. So actually, this is my best. And now I've grown. So now this is my best. So that's our saying. That's our culture. Be your best, then be better. So then it's not enough to be your best.
Yeah. Wise words. Wise words.
That's Mark, something we made up. That's not something we stole from a book or
no. It's very, very useful. Proud of. Very useful, very timely as well. So I want to thank you so much.
Hope that you've gotten some, or your audience gets good value out of this. I hope, even if you can get one.
I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will.
I'd be very happy.
I'm sure they will. Like, this has been a genuinely useful conversation, Mark. I really appreciate your time with me. And I think a lot of business owners and audience are heard themselves in parts of this conversation. I think you gave them a lot of self-reflection. The blind spots, the confidence gap, the fear of tackling hard things alone. They don't have to. They've got you. And thanks. Thank you so much for being part of this conversation. I really appreciate you joining me today. Before I close this recording, any last comments, Mark?
I just want to say thank you for for doing what you do, because you're bringing these kind of things that are quite unique. Like, there's a lot of stuff on social media. You see the same thing. People tend to copy each other, and it becomes a bit of a copy and paste. But, you know, I think this is a unique conversation that I don't generally see out there. And it's great to have the conversation and great to have the persistence, because sometimes these kind of channels, they're not the ones with 50 million subscribers. And, you know, it's a hard thing to be able to do and keep pushing through with. So I appreciate that you're doing what you're doing. And I was speaking to a billionaire. I went to his house and we were talking about social media, and he said, I think a lot of the social media out there is garbage. I'd rather have 5,000 followers and talk sense than have 5 million followers and do these silly pranks that hurt people and just talk garbage and people just mindlessly looking. You're making people dumber by doing that. And he said, I'd rather just focus on a few people and add huge value, as opposed to just waste a lot of people's time and rot their brain. So I really, really resonate and agree with that. So I think this is one of those conversations, the questions you ask, the approach you've taken, that really brings out a conversation that could potentially be very, very valuable if someone was really absorbing it. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate you being with me. And you're absolutely correct. It is not about the volume, it's about the quality of these conversations. Mm-hmm. 2.5 years in this now, and I'm only focused on one thing, is have genuine, authentic conversation with guests, respected guests such as yourself, Mark. Thanks again for joining me. I really appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to, on your behalf and my behalf and the channel, I want to thank Mark Lim for joining me today all the way from Australia, for being such a good guest, brought a lot of information, a lot of knowledge to this conversation. And I really look forward to having you on the channel one more time. Mark, please consider it your channel. Anytime you want to come back for an update, I'm happy to host you. It is a single person effort, this channel. It's just myself. I've managed over the years to automate a lot of the post-editing stuff that I do, so I don't have to wait 2 or 3 weeks to produce an episode. Most of this stuff has been done by me, but I'm a programmer by trade, so I've written a lot of programs to automate some of the stuff, so I'm able to push them out pretty quickly. If you have a YouTube channel, if you want to send me as a collaborator, I'll add you as a collaborator so your team can use the channel in a way that you find useful. And that's all I'm trying to be here, is useful to you and to our audience. To the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you're coming in on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming in on our podcast streams, thanks for listening in. And by the way, if you are checking us out on the blog site where I summarize all these conversations in a consumable way, it takes you 2-3 minutes to read on our blog site, robinayoub.blog. Thanks for checking us out. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.